Well, I'll see if I can spend less than 30 minutes per slide. That first one involved a lot of a chemistry primer of sorts, which should have all been review material, but I think it's important to hear all that stuff again to cement it in your mind. The second slide just gives you an appreciation of the strength of covalent bonds. Now, ionic bonds are not shown on here. They would be lower in energy. Notice also that this is a logarithmic scale. But the higher on this scale, the stronger the bond. And covalent bonds are the strongest chemical bonds, stronger than ionic bonds, as I was saying yesterday. And also within covalent bonds, notice that triple bonds are stronger than double bonds are stronger than single bonds. And also there's even variety of strength of bonds depending on which two kinds of atoms are interacting covalently. And we'll talk much more about that later and the significance of that. It's important for covalent bonds to be strong, by the way, otherwise we wouldn't exist because just energy of sunlight would continuously break bonds if they weren't strong enough. So we owe our existence to the strength of covalent bonds. Hydrogen bonds are way down here, and I say way down here because this is a logarithmic scale. And they're not chemical bonds. Hydrogen bonds are really important. We also owe our lives to hydrogen bonds, which I'll talk more about today. But they don't hold things together to form a new compound like ionic and covalent bonds do. Let's go to slide 3 and look at some examples of some organic compounds. So remember, a compound is organic not only because it has carbon. That's not enough. It has to have carbon and hydrogen, and there's usually oxygen, often nitrogen in there as well, and other things. That's why the 4 biggies that make you up atomically are carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and hydrogen. So the biological macromolecules that we are made of include mostly those atoms. Well, by the way, before I leave the tetravalence issue that I started last time, carbon is special because of its tetravalence. It's not unique. It's not the only tetravalent atom. In fact, any element within a group, within the same group, has the same valence, right? Remember, groups are columns. So there are other tetravalent atoms along with carbon. What is special about carbon in that tetravalent group?
Most common.
Yes, it is the most common, and why? What also is special about it, just in terms of the periodic table? If I were to ask a kindergartner to look at the periodic table and say, what is special about carbon in this list? It's at the top. It's at the top of the list, which means because of how the periodic table is arranged by atomic number, that means carbon is the smallest, the simplest tetravalent atom. And so that's why we're based on carbon, because of its tetravalence and its smallness. So these are just examples of organic compounds: ethane and propane, ethylene, acetylene, and so on. These are different from each other, obviously, but they have something in common. What do all of these share, other than the fact that they are organic? Right, they are all hydrocarbons, which you should not confuse that word hydrocarbon with the word carbohydrate, which are similar etymologically. A hydrocarbon is a compound consisting of nothing but carbon and hydrogen atoms, whereas a carbohydrate has carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. All right, so these are nothing but carbon and hydrogen, which make for very good fuels. That's why we use these things as fuels. And what makes them good fuels is because of these carbon carbon bonds and carbon hydrogen bonds. So I have to talk a little bit about electronegativity. Electronegativity is a feature of any atom. It's a value we give. The an element's electronegativity is its affinity for electrons, how much it attracts electrons to itself, basically, how much it wants to have them part of itself. And so the greater the value of electronegativity, the more strongly electrons are attracted to that kind of atom. So there's the periodic table is arranged by atomic number, of course, but there are trends in it. And it's not a perfect trend, but generally speaking, electronegativity on the periodic table goes from low values at the lower left corner, increases to the upper right, except for the noble gases. And so what is the most electronegative element?
Fluorine.
Fluorine, right up there in the upper right corner, except for the noble gases. All right, so fluorine really wants wants electrons for itself, and so does chlorine and things that are around it. Carbon has a moderate electronegativity, and it's roughly equal to the electronegativity of hydrogen. Now, we've already talked about the fact that covalent bonds are bonds based on sharing of electrons. So the electrons that are shared in a covalent bond spend some amount of time around each of the two atomic nuclei. So any covalent bond is a sharing of electrons. But that doesn't mean that it's equal sharing, right? How much equality of sharing there is depends on the comparison of the electronegativities for the two atoms involved. If you have a carbon-carbon bond, a bond between two carbon atoms, they obviously have identical electronegativities, right? So that's an equal sharing. And since carbon and hydrogen have roughly equal electronegativities, it's a pretty equal sharing as well. When there's an equal sharing of electrons, because of roughly equal electronegativities, what kind of a covalent bond are we talking about?
Non-polar.
A non-polar bond. Right, a non-polar covalent bond is about equal sharing of electrons. But if there is a drastic difference in the electronegativities of the two atoms involved, like there is, for instance, with carbon and oxygen, because oxygen has a much higher electronegativity than carbon, then even though there still is going to be sharing, it's going to be unequal sharing, which means electrons are going to be spending more time around the atom with higher electronegativity. And since electrons themselves are negatively charged, that means there's going to be a partial negative charge associated with the atom of that bond that has the higher electronegativity. That's what makes for a polar covalent bond, right? Well, this is really important in biology for various reasons that we're going to talk about. These hydrocarbons, and not just these hydrocarbons in general are nonpolar compounds because they're made up of nonpolar covalent bonds because carbon and hydrogen have roughly equal electronegativities. All right? Well, the reason that makes them good fuels is because since those electrons are being shared equally, they're not really particularly close to either to any atomic nucleus at a time. And closeness to an atomic nucleus corresponds to stability. So these electrons are at a higher energy level. They are more unstable when they're being equally shared. Electrons become more stable as they get closer to an atomic nucleus, right? So higher instability or being less stable is an energetic situation, and you can exploit that if you allow the system to go to a more stable state. That's a release of energy. This is what we do with the food we eat. We break those bonds. We oxidize those fuels so that electrons end up being closer to atomic nuclei so that we can exploit some of the energy that's released in order to do the various things that require energy in our cells, including building our own molecules from scratch out of the raw materials that we get from breaking down the foods we eat. Okay, let's go to 4 and look at some functional groups. This is not an exhaustive list of functional groups, but you've probably studied functional groups. They are not molecules, which is why they don't have complete structures here. Each one of them has an unmet bond, which just represents that this functional group is really connected to something else. It's part of a bigger, complete molecule. And they're called functional groups for good reason. Even though they might just be a tiny part of the overall molecule, as far as number of atoms is concerned, because of their chemistry, this functional group's chemistry, they give whatever molecule they're a member of a particular function. A good example of this is the various steroid hormones, which includes not only sex hormones, but other hormones. But just if you concentrate on the sex hormone, first of all the steroid hormones are very similar. They all come from, they all start out as what? Cholesterol. They all start out as the same molecule that just gets modified, but it's a slight modification. It's just a rearrangement of functional groups. The main part of the molecule is the same. In estrogen, for instance, versus testosterone, which are pretty opposite in a sense, right? One is a feminizing hormone, one is a masculizing hormone. Have drastically different effects, but very, very similar molecularly. Just a slight difference in their functional groups. So functional groups can really determine what a given biological molecule is doing in a cell. So carboxyls are these ones, like I said, this is not an exhaustive list. This is a list of really important ones in biology, though, important functional groups. Carboxyls are important for various reasons. For one thing, every amino acid has a carboxyl group by definition, as it also has an amino group. Well, organisms don't do well without proteins. You can't have proteins without amino acids, so those are very important. Phosphate is important as a member of nucleic acids. In fact, as a member of each monomer of a nucleic acid, which is a nucleotide, has phosphate. But so do molecules like ATP, which are important for energy metabolism. And also phosphorylating other molecules, meaning sticking a phosphate onto another molecule, is a much used way of controlling the action of biological molecules. For instance, enzymes can be either activated or deactivated by phosphorylating or dephosphorylating them. So it's used as a switch, basically. Hydroxyls make things alcohols. So anything with a hydroxyl group is an alcohol, including cholesterol. Things that end in OL are alcohols. They're important in biology. Sulfhydryls are important also in proteins because they are a functional group of cysteine, which is an amino acid. They can get together and form covalent bonds to really stabilize the structure of proteins. Carbonyls are important components of sugars. Aldehydes we find also in sugars. For instance, these are just examples. That's not the only reason they're important. But anyway, notice that functional groups have their own chemistry, and that's why they cause the molecule to function a certain way. So that's why we're grouping them broadly into negatively charged, positively charged, or neutral but polar. All right, now to 5. So the tetravalence of carbon is gives it a lot of versatility chemically, right? We've already talked about this. The fact that it's able to make four bonds, which is more than most atoms, means that it can form single bonds with four different things, or four of the same thing, or it can form a single bond and a triple bond, or two double bonds, like I was saying. That alone allows for quite a bit of diversity. But there's an additional level of diversity when you get into chirality. Now, chiral, C-H-I-R-A-L, means what, literally? Means handed, right. Chiro is a combining form that means hand. Like chiropractor, yeah. Or chiromancer, or other words. It's a good word for a molecule in which a central carbon is singly bonded to four different things, though. Because if you bother to build that with pegs and balls, ball and stick model like you see here, if there are, you know, the carbon is in the middle, and then the four things are at the four vertices of a tetrahedron. If those things at the vertices are different, all different from each other, if it's four different atoms that are being bonded with that central carbon, then there are two ways that you can do that, two ways that you can build that. If you look at the left picture, there is no way that you can just pick up that model and rearrange it in space and make it look like the one on the right. The only way you could make the one on the right is if you took the model at least partially apart and rearranged it. Analogously, there's no way that you can make your left hand, even just by moving it around, be like your right hand. They're mirror images of each other. That's chirality. That's handedness of molecules. And so that's even greater versatility, because now you have two versions of a molecule in which exactly the same atoms are involved in exactly the same kind of bonds. So another level of versatility. And that's just if there's a single carbon. If you have a multiple carbon skeleton, then there can be multiple degrees of chirality. And that's why there can be quite a few different monosaccharides, for instance. Many more monosaccharides possible chemically than most cells use. It gets out of hand quickly as you grow the carbon skeleton. So that's also part of the diversity of organic chemistry. By the way, if you don't appreciate it as diversity because it might seem that the right and left-hand versions are really the same thing, they're not. You know, you can signals in the body, which include hormones and neurotransmitters and things like that, they operate by binding as ligands to receptors, right? The receptor has to have the right shape for that. Well, just like a left-handed glove is not going to fit your right hand very well, a receptor has to be the right-handedness to receive a chiral signal. And so, for instance, in the pharmaceutical industry, there's always money being spent to develop new drugs. Drugs that often just mimic signals that naturally occur in the body. So they bind to some receptor that we make. Well, often those are chiral molecules. And so if they manufacture the wrong one, it would do nothing, because it would be like a left hand fitting into a right-handed glove. They have to make the right kind. Yeah.
Basically, if there's a molecule that has to be a certain chirality that will fit into the chiral receptor, why isn't it just like flip around 180?
Because that's what I'm saying, it is impossible. Flipping around 180 does not change it into the other version. Actually, rearranging the bonds does. You have to break bonds and form new ones in order to turn it into the left or right-handed version from the other one. That's why. So, both versions exist, but only one version in any given organism is the one that's functional. So we see that in slide 6 as an example using amino acids on the top. This alanine is an amino acid. There's no limit to the number of amino acids that you can make. So don't think that there are 20 amino acids, even though that's probably been hammered in your head up to this point. There are 20 amino acids that organisms use, but you could manufacture any kind of amino acid you want in the laboratory because that fourth position can be anything you want. All right? So anyway, alanine is one of the 20 biological amino acids, but there are two versions of it, as you see here, L and D. Now, does anyone know what the L and D configurations for? Levo, which means left-handed, and dextro, which means right-handed. Dextrous literally means right-handed. Ambidextrous literally means having two right hands, which is not true, of course, but it's kind of just... It reflects the fact that we... The majority of humans are right-handed for whatever reason. Similarly with monosaccharides, there's multiple versions of glucose. Glucose does not actually narrow it down enough. D-glucose is shown here. Okay, now let's talk more about polar bonds. Slide 7. We have here a representation of water molecules. And water is an example of a polar compound. And that's because there's a pretty big difference in electronegativity values between oxygen and hydrogen. Oxygen's electronegativity is significantly higher than hydrogen's. It more greedily grabs for the electrons, if you want to anthropomorphize things. So there is a sharing of electrons. The oxygen-hydrogen bond is covalent, but it's an unequal sharing. The electrons spend more time around the oxygen, and since they're carrying negative charge, that makes the oxygen region of the overall water molecule slightly negative. So this is not an ion. It's not a fully charged particle. It has a partial charge, which is why we usually designate it with a lowercase delta. Delta minus means slightly negative. Delta positive means slightly positive. There's a delta positive for each of the two hydrogens because there's two bonds in the molecule, obviously. So when you have polar compounds, as you do in biology often, because there's a lot of bonds between oxygen and hydrogen or nitrogen and hydrogen. Nitrogen also has a higher electronegativity than hydrogen. Then the individual molecules of these polar compounds, which would normally pretty much ignore each other, have a slight attraction for each other all of a sudden because of the slight charges that are at different regions of the molecules. And so water molecules, let's consider the example of a nonpolar population of molecules. An oxygen molecule, for instance, is nonpolar, right? Even though oxygen has a very high electronegativity and greedily grabs for the electrons, in an oxygen molecule, you have two equally greedy atoms. So since they're identical in their electronegativities, the electrons end up being equally shared. And so that's nonpolar. So in a population of oxygen molecules, as you have in some volume of pure oxygen gas, the oxygen molecules don't really care what each other are doing. They collide into each other now and then, but they're not attracted to each other. Not so with a population of water molecules. Thankfully so, because we wouldn't exist if it weren't for hydrogen bonds that occurs between water molecules. So in a population of water molecules, when they approach each other, they will swivel in a way that allows the partially negative oxygen of one water molecule to be attracted to the partially positive hydrogen of another water molecule. And so this gives a stickiness, in a sense, an attractive force, and it gives a population of water molecules slightly more order than there would be if they weren't polar. And hydrogen bonds, like I said earlier, are not chemical bonds. That doesn't make new stuff. And it's not a very permanent bond, very short-lived bond. It still is more than nothing. And we owe our lives to that for various reasons. It's important that hydrogen bonds be very weak, actually, for a lot of reasons. One reason is for how our DNA works. This is a good example to appreciate the strength of covalent bonds and the weakness of hydrogen bonds, right? DNA is double-stranded. It's an informational molecule. The information consists of, or doesn't exist without, the particular sequence of nucleotides in that nucleic acid. So in order to operate as an informational molecule, it has to have sequence integrity. You can't dismantle that sequence or you'll lose the information. Well, that sequence of nucleotides that make up the strand is maintained by hydrogen bonds, right? Each adjacent nucleotide is held to its partner with a covalent bond. Therefore, those don't break easily and the information is maintained. On the other hand, it's a double-stranded molecule, and the other strand is hydrogen bonded to the first strand very weakly, right? That's important because in order to use DNA for its jobs, which are transcription and replication, you have to be able to separate the two strands from each other. If they were covalently bonded, that would be a much harder job. So they're pretty much easy to unzip and re-zip back together with hydrogen bonding. So this partial charge is why we have hydrogen bonding between water molecules, but also between other types of molecules that have polar covalent bonds in them. When it comes to just water itself, though, this polarity of water gives it several special characters. Water is unusual as a substance for various reasons. One, I know that I'm on slide 8 right now, but I'm not talking about slide 8 yet. One thing that's unusual about water is that it is more dense in liquid form than it is in solid form. Not very many things are like that, right? The usual case as you go from gas to liquid to solid is that the molecules of that substance are getting closer and closer together as you go from gas to solid, right? That's the difference between a gas and a liquid. In liquid, the particles are much closer together than they are in the gas. And if you get them by lowering the temperature to get even closer, then you have a solid. Well, density refers to the number of particles in a given amount of volume. So if they're packed together more tightly, there's a higher density. And therefore, solids for most substances are heavier per volume than liquids are. But that's not true with water, as you know, because ice floats, right? It's important that ice float, that it does float. If ice didn't float, then we wouldn't be here because bodies of water would freeze from the bottom up and eventually they would freeze solid. Instead, the freezing that occurs when it gets cold will occur at the surface, allowing for liquid water below it where things can still live over the winter. Then when the thaw comes, all of that ice gets turned back into liquid water. If the ice that first formed because of the cold that season were denser than liquid, like it would be for any other substance, the ice would fall to the bottom, being more dense, and it would form a certain thickness. The next thaw, well, that energy wouldn't penetrate deeply enough to thaw all that ice, so that it would be, you'd lose some of that thickness at the bottom, but not all of it. And therefore, the next winter, it would add to that, and so it would get a little bit thicker each year, and eventually you'd have nothing but solid ice instead of liquid bodies, and so we wouldn't have evolved. The picture that we see in slide 8 is another special property of water, which is the surface tension that it has, which is why this animal is able to walk on the surface of the water. So surface tension, like you see in this picture, looks like the water has a skin at the surface that's thicker and tougher than the main depth of the water itself. Well, it's more than seeming like that. That's actually the case. That's why this thing is able to walk on the water, because of this skin. Now, it's not a solid skin, but it is a thicker layer. And hydrogen bonding is the reason that it occurs. Okay, so because of this cohesiveness of water, cohesion is a force of attraction between particles of the same kind. Water coheres with other water molecules. If you imagine a beaker full of water, so there's all kinds of water molecules in there. Imagine any of the water molecules that are somewhere down in the depth of the water. They're all being attracted to water molecules around them in all directions. All right, so they're being pulled by these hydrogen bonds in all directions, basically. Now imagine the ones that are at the surface. They're also being pulled by water molecules, but there's only water molecules below them. So they're being compressed downward, but not being pulled up by ones at the top, because there aren't any ones above them. So they're being pulled from one side only, and that compresses that top layer of water molecules, makes it more dense, like the little skin that seems to appear and actually is appearing in this picture. Another important property of water is that it makes for an excellent solvent. I said the first day that life is really just aqueous solution chemistry, right? Chemical reactions that are occurring in aqueous solution. So water is the solvent in life. It's not the solvent in chemistry, but whenever we're talking about solvents in biology, it's water. Well, water is a good solvent. It's able to dissolve things, in other words, well, because of its polarity once again. The example shown here is sodium chloride. Sodium chloride is an ionic compound, like I said, a salt. But when you introduce sodium chloride, however big a chunk, into water, you no longer really have sodium chloride, right? What you have instead are now isolated, dissociated sodium particles and chloride particles. Individual ions now that are no longer being allowed to interact with each other, because they are each surrounded by a population of water molecules. Water, because of its polarity, has one side of it that's partially positive, one side that's partially negative. Sodium chloride is an ionic compound, but the sodium in sodium chloride is a cation, the chloride is an anion. So if water gets in there and separates the two, and each water molecule swivels in such a way so that the oppositely charged part of the water molecule is juxtaposed with the ion. That's why the position of the water molecules is the opposite around the sodium ion compared to how they're arranged around the chloride ion. They do this because the partial charge that water has is attracted to the full charge of the ion of opposite sign. Okay, so it solubilizes things very well, water does, because of its polar nature. Okay, before I actually start 10, which is another important thing about cells, let me say a couple more things about water. Compared to most things, water has also a high specific heat capacity. Now, any given chemical has a specific heat capacity, which is simply the amount of energy that's required to raise the temperature of that stuff, of 1 gram of that stuff, by 1 Kelvin or 1 centigrade degree. So there's a value given for specific heat capacity for any given substance. The value for water is higher than most substances, which means, because of that high specific heat capacity, that water is comparatively hard to change the temperature of. It's hard to heat up, it's hard to cool down. And this provides a thermal buffer. This, by the way, is why bodies of water undergo much less amplitude of temperature during the day than the land does. You know, it's an equal amount of sunlight hitting water and land that's right next to the water is going to heat the land up to a higher temperature than it is the water. But then at night, the land is going to cool to a lower temperature than the water is because of that stabilizing effect of the high specific heat capacity of water. Beyond that, water also has a fairly high latent heat of vaporization. So the latent heat of vaporization, anyone know what that is? Yeah. That's right. The latent heat of vaporization for whatever substance is the amount of energy required to transform a gram of that stuff from liquid to gas. To evaporate it, in other words. And so things that we call volatile chemicals, which means they evaporate easily, like perfume, they have very low latent heats of vaporization, which is why they evaporate so easily. Water has a fairly high latent heat of vaporization. And so that means it takes a lot of energy to transform it into steam or water vapor. Well, this saves your life many days of the year living here. This is why sweating saves your life, right? When you sweat, the liquid water that is your sweat collects on the surface, but then it evaporates from that surface. And when it evaporates, that sheds heat from your body, heat that would otherwise kill you. Well, this is once again due to hydrogen bonding. Let's think about what happens during evaporation for a second. Evaporation means going from liquid to a gas, which means, from the viewpoint of an individual molecule, that means escaping from this dense population, which is the liquid, and going off on your own. All right? Now, in a body of water, like sweat, those trillions of water molecules are all randomly moving at their own, in their own direction until they collide with something, and at their own speed, right? What is the temperature of something? What does temperature really refer to? Right. Temperature is a measure of the average speed of the particles of that substance. Now, I say average speed because all the particles are moving at their own speed. And that's, those speeds are continuously changing as they bounce off of each other, just like billiard balls are moving at different speeds and keep adjusting their speed as they bounce off of the bumpers and the other balls. But if you were able to get in there and measure them all and then take an average, that would be the temperature, basically. Now, if you are a water molecule trying to evaporate, trying to go off on your own, what would give you the best chance? First of all, you have to be at the surface, right? If you're one of these ones buried in the depth, you're not going to make it out on your own because you're going to run into something else. But if you're lucky enough to be at the surface, and eventually they're all going to be at the surface, but if you're at the surface at the moment, what gets you the best? What gives you the best chance of escaping off into the vapor phase? Going fast, exactly. The faster a water molecule is traveling, the greater chance it has of escaping that surface. All right? So that's the water molecules that actually do evaporate first. The fastest ones of the population that's in the liquid phase. So in other words, as you evaporate liquid water into gas, what you're doing is eliminating the fastest members of the liquid population. What's that going to do to the average speed of the liquid that's left behind? It's going to go down, right? You're getting rid of the fastest ones of the class. So average speed is temperature. That's why evaporation cools the water. Or cools the sweat, and therefore, by conduction, cools your body. The energy lost goes into breaking the hydrogen bonds. This is why water has a high latent heat of vaporization. Water molecules aren't as freely able to escape that surface as they would with in a nonpolar substance because hydrogen bonds are holding them behind, meaning that you have to be even faster than you would otherwise to be able to break out of that surface. All right? So all kinds of special properties of water based on its ability to form hydrogen bonding, which in turn is because of its polarity. Now in slide 10, we're looking at another very important molecule that it's impossible to overstate the importance of this molecule as well. Not this particular molecule, but this class of molecules. What we have here is a phospholipid. And phospholipids are special in that they are examples of molecules that are said to be amphipathic. What does the word amphipathic literally mean? Have you heard this word before? Well, chemically, yeah, the chemical definition of an amphipathic molecule is that it is a molecule that has a partial or a total charge on it somewhere, and part of it is nonpolar as well. So it's partly polar and partly nonpolar at the same time, but at different places. Linguistically, amphipathic means having dual preferences. Amphi means dual or both. For instance, an amphitheater, for instance, right? An amphitheater is partly indoors, partly outdoors. And the word amphibian, well, that's amphibian, really. The bi as in biology, meaning life. So amphibian means having a dual lifestyle, living part of your lifetime in water, part of your lifetime on land. The pathos part of amphipathic means feeling. And so amphipathic means having dual feelings, referring to the fact that it's polar on one end and nonpolar on another end. Well, it's not just humans that owe our lives to this. It's everything, because we wouldn't have cells without amphipathic molecules, specifically phospholipids. And that's because we can't have a cell unless we have a phospholipid. I mean, unless we have a plasma membrane. Plasma membranes are phospholipid bilayers. Now, it's more than just a phospholipid bilayer. Of course, there are other things in there as well. But the very first cells to exist, even before they were truly cells, you had little bags made out of phospholipid bilayers. And that's simply because of the amphipathic nature of phospholipids. So I'm sure you've seen these models before. The cartoon of a phospholipid is typically a round head, which is the polar region. That's where you have a partial or total charge, depending on what is sitting there. And then two nonpolar tails. Why are the nonpolar tails nonpolar? Exactly, because they are hydrocarbons. And we've already discussed that hydrocarbons are, by nature, already nonpolar. Why is that, again? Carbon and hydrogen have the same electronegativity, pretty much, yes. And so if it's a hydrocarbon tail, there's nothing but carbons and hydrogens in this. And therefore, no tendency for electrons to be spend more time around any of the two atoms. So the tails are the nonpolar part. Well, nonpolar things tend to not want to be around polar things, including water, right? Water is a polar compound, like we just talked about. These nonpolar tails really have nothing they want to do with water, whereas the polar head has no problem at all being around water, because it's just as polar as water is. Therefore, if you just introduce in the laboratory billions of phospholipids, just as chemicals, nothing to do with any living organism, just put them into water, they will self-assemble into bilayers simply because of their amphipathic nature. The nonpolar part, there's another word that you can use to describe that based on the affinity for water. What is that? Nonpolar tails are what? No, they're not hydrophilic. They're hydrophobic, right. Literally water-fearing. Whereas hydrophilic means water-loving. So the polar head that's hydrophilic. So polar things are hydrophilic, nonpolar things are hydrophobic. And an amphipathic molecule like a phospholipid has a hydrophobic end to it, the two tails, and a hydrophilic end to it, the polar head. When introduced into water, they're going to arrange themselves just for reasons of stability, so that these tails are minimizing their contact with water, so that there isn't polar interacting with nonpolar. The way you do that, of course, is to form a bilayer, just like we see in slide 11. A phospholipid bilayer gets arranged in this manner so that the tails are of one monolayer of the bilayer, are arranged next to the tails in the other monolayer. The heads, on the other hand, are pointed away from each other. This is the perfect situation because the heads have no problem being around the water, which on one monolayer will be the water of the exterior, and the heads on the interior monolayer have no problem being around the water that's inside what is now a bag, essentially. That's how the first cell started. And that's our ancestor and every other organism's ancestor on Earth. So that's why it's impossible to overstate the importance of phospholipids. But they're called phospholipids, of course, because there's a phosphate group in them, as you see in back in slide 10. I forgot to mention that when I was there. All right, let's stop there.